Welcome to Naming a Trust as a Designated Beneficiary, Understanding Private Letter Ruling 2010-21038. Reformation of a Trust Does Not Save Designated Beneficiary Status. I'm Bob Keebler, and today I'll be your host to go through this important private letter ruling. Let me give you first an executive summary of the ruling, then I'd like to talk a little bit about naming a trust as a beneficiary of an IRA, and then we'll come back and go through in some detail the facts of this ruling. I've also written this ruling up for Lissy, and you'll be able to read much of what I say in the ruling. Now, let's start with an executive summary. In Private Letter Ruling 2010-21038, the service ruled that the retroactive reformation of a trust would not be respected for purposes of the 4019 rules. Okay, so basically, under the 4019 regulation, there's a provision that you do not measure the designated beneficiary of a trust until September 30th following the year of death. So in the past, we'll talk about this, but there's been several rulings where the service has respected reformations. Now, the service has changed their mind on this. So the really important message in this ruling, based upon this ruling and our prior negotiations with the service, is that the service will not respect retroactive trust reformations for purposes of creating a designated beneficiary trust, a DBT, if you will. In this this is so important because it raises the bar of the care and precision that's going to be needed by lawyers when they're drafting these designated beneficiary trusts. So basically, in this ruling, the trustee reformed the trust, and the reformation seems artful. Based upon what I read in the ruling, this was very well done. The trustee reformed, and I was not involved in this, the trustee reformed the trust pursuant to a state court order to remove charities that were potential beneficiaries under a power of appointment. So this is a very critical thing to understand. So the trust was poisoned by the presence of two things. One is the charitable beneficiary, or potential charitable beneficiary, and secondly, a power of appointment that would have allowed for the appointment of assets to an older beneficiary. So these are two things that poisoned this trust. So what undoubtedly happened is a trustee or a lawyer, a CPA, someone saw this after the parties died, and they said, this trust is not going to qualify as a designated beneficiary trust. Let's go to court and reform this. Now, let's start with some basics before we go into the detail. Keep in mind, when done correctly, you're allowed to name a trust a designated beneficiary of an IRA. And basically, an IRA can be payable to a trust, and when done right, IRA distributions are going to occur over the life expectancy of the oldest trust beneficiary. So this is very important. Now, there are some tests that have to be made, and these tests come under the 401A9-4 regulations. And basically, you may have heard this before, a trust has to be valid under state law, the trust is irrevocable upon the death of the owner, the beneficiaries of the trust are identifiable from the trust instrument. This is a critical component of this. And there's also a documentation requirement where a copy of the trust has to be provided to the plan administrator. There's also a way to provide a summary of the trust if you do not want to provide the entire trust. Now, why do people want trust beneficiaries? For the same reason people have wanted trusts as to be beneficiaries of it and hold assets for the last 500 years. Unified credit trusts, marital trusts, generation skipping trusts, trusts for handicapped individuals. Maybe I want a trust for my spouse to ensure that he or she receives income all the time. So if I die, my wife receives income from this trust and the remainder goes to our children. I mean, so there's plenty of good, solid reasons to do this. Now, the problem is the government has set up a labyrinth of rules, and they're somewhat hyper-technical, and that's why such care is required on the behalf of drafting counsel. Now, big picture-wise, there are two types of trusts at work. One is an accumulation trust, which would be about 85% of the trusts most of us would be involved with. The other kind is a conduit trust. In a accumulation trust, the trustee has the ability to accumulate property within the trust. The trustee has the ability to exercise good judgment. In a conduit trust, all the distributions from the IRA are required to be paid out to the beneficiaries, so that you do not receive the same level of asset protection. Now, a conduit trust is a trust in which all distributions from the IRA are immediately distributed to the trust beneficiaries. So a conduit trust is basically, I have my IRA payable to a trust, I die, my child has a 30-year life expectancy, there's $30,000 in the trust, the first year we divide by 30, and we take out $1,000. And if it was $3 million in the trust, we'd divide by 30 and we take out $100,000. That's what a conduit trust does. It unfortunately doesn't give you a lot of asset protection. Now, there are cases where a conduit trust is very appropriate. For example, I die, I have a $500,000 IRA, and I have $10 million in my revocable trust, and it's all for one child who's basically a very solid person. Okay, if that's the case, we might just leave, have conduit language in the revocable trust to make all this work. So we might just have conduit language in the trust to make all this work. And the reason we would do that is because it's immaterial compared to the entire estate. Now, on the other hand, an accumulation trust, let's just say that we have a child who basically is continually has issues. We'll just define issues broadly. But that's where you'd want the trustee to be able to exercise good judgment. And so you draft the trust a little bit differently. But when you have a conduit trust, it's easier to qualify under these 401A9 rules, and we'll talk about that in a second. Now, when you have an accumulation trust, the key issue is analyzing which beneficiaries are countable. And all beneficiaries are countable unless such beneficiaries deemed to be a mere successor potential beneficiary. So what we're going to have to do is look at every beneficiary. Now, here's the best example I have of this, is that when we look at a situation, and I looked one time at a family member's trust, and this particular individual, his trust was payable to his children with a remainder to his, in the event all the children died, to his grandchildren. It's pretty straightforward. In the event that everyone died, it went to his sister, and in the event his sister died, it went to their aunt, who was 99 years old. Well, under these rules, the 99-year-old would have been the measuring life. So what do you do? What you would do is you would not have the 99-year-old as a beneficiary of this particular trust. But in a conduit trust, compare that. If that was a conduit trust, you would simply have to have it pay all the IRA distributions will go to the children, and you stop measuring right there. So that's the important difference. Now, let's come back to this ruling and put all this in perspective, because what can go wrong when you have an accumulation trust? And that's what happened in this ruling. You had an accumulation trust. If you have a charitable beneficiary or the ability to appoint to an older beneficiary, we can't determine the measuring life, and that's the problem. So basically, the facts of this ruling were straightforward. Husband and wife drafted a revocable trust. Trust appears to be very straightforward, with a survivor's trust, marital trust, and bypass trust. And upon the death of the surviving spouse, the trust divided into various trusts for family members. Now, the trust contained a clause that upon the death of the beneficiary, the first-tier beneficiary, that beneficiary could appoint assets to persons and entities, including charity. And then, so what happened here is the trust even contained really good reformation language. And I'll read that to you. But it reads, the trustee will use his or her best efforts to minimize income taxes on these assets for maximum duration permitted by law. For purposes of qualifying for a designated beneficiary under IRC, under the Internal Revenue Code and applicable regulations, each beneficiary may amend the terms of the trust which govern the distribution of his or her trust at death in absence of a complete and effective exercise of any applicable power of appointment. So they were trying to get it so the trustee could fix this. The problem is, so wife dies, later the husband dies. At this point in time, people take a good look at this trust. And at that point in time, someone recognized that this language, that they had to reform the trust. And so basically, they went ahead and reformed the trust. But the government's position under Lemire's and under Nurseryman and a handful of other cases, which are all very very well laid out in the ruling, is basically that you cannot reform a trust after someone dies to get a better tax result. Now, the problem is the government's missing the September 30th date. Now, obviously, they know it's there. But I think what was under the original regulations, which were drafted by a lady named Marjorie Hoffman, she was trying to carve out, and this is based upon, you know, 15 years of looking at this, what Ms. Hoffman was trying to carve out was this ability to measure after I die. That, and so, for example, if a disclaimer occurred, we'd measure after the disclaimer. Or if a charity was paid off, you'd measure after the charity was paid off. The problem, in my opinion, in this ruling is that we had this power of appointment. And the power of appointment was so broad, it was impossible to define exactly who the beneficiaries were. And that's why they went to court to reform this. Now, the Reformation was very well drafted. I mean, there's extremely good drafting on the Reformation. So I think what you have here is the government saying, basically, we have to measure everything as of the date of death, okay? So, you know, but in earlier private letter rulings, the service allowed a trust to be reformed after death. If you look at private letter ruling 2002-35-038 and 2006-226, you're going to see two rulings where they allowed a reformation after death. Now, they've also, there's some earlier rulings where they allowed beneficiary designation forms to be amended, but they've also changed their position on that. Now, so the message seems to have changed, and the service's position today, and if it's eventually sustained by the tax court, the burden on drafting lawyers is going to be very high. Now, we believe that the service is probably wrong on this. And, you know, the proper position under the 401A9 regulations and certainly the right public policy is to allow for postmortem reformations to meet these rules. Again, these rules are very complicated, and it's totally unreasonable to expect that every person drafting a trust in the United States is going to know these rules. So the important issue is whether or not the designated beneficiary can be determined by September 30th. Now, the case law addressing the retroactive trust reformations does not address a conflict between these longstanding judicial doctrines that the service continues to win on and the requirement that a reformation or that a change can occur under the 401A9 rules. So that's something I think will eventually be reconciled by the tax court. My guess is how this plays out is someone will die with a very large IRA, and the trust will be reformed, and then there'll be litigation on these issues. The problem is, to get to the litigation stage, you're going to have to probably incur the 50% penalty, and that's what people may be very much afraid of. Now, we believe that a disclaimer or a beneficiary payout should still be respected, but the service is trying to draw a line at the reformations. So what you really have to do when you're drafting these trusts is to make sure you're meeting the requirements of the 401A9 regulations up front. Now, if you remember, back 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, Phil Cavish, who's an attorney in California, he retained us to help him get a private letter ruling on where a trust began after death as a conduit trust, and then the trustee amended that to make it an accumulation trust. I think that type of planning, it may even have more applicability now. It's something we're going to have to continue to review because at the end of the day, that would create a safety net, because first you'd qualify under the conduit provisions, and then you could take a very hard look at your accumulation provisions just to make sure the law hasn't changed since the day the trust was drafted. Because the problem is, you could draft a trust today, the service could tighten up these rules 10 years from now, and the person could die 2 years after that. And they would die with a trust that was perfect on the day it was drafted, but then it changed later. So those are all things that we want to look at. So remember, this is evolving here, but I do think the real moral of the story for drafting lawyers is that we have to be extremely careful. Counsel has to be extremely careful when these trusts are put together, and to make sure that you qualify under the 401A9 rules. And it may be easier to begin these trusts as conduit trusts with the trustee having the ability to then change them to accumulation trusts, because certainly on the date of death, you would still have a trust that would qualify and changing it at that point in time to an accumulation trust, as long as you respect all these other rules, would allow the trust to continue to qualify. So again, thank you for joining us today. We will keep a very close eye on these developments for Lineberg Information Services, and every effort we've made to keep you completely informed as this evolves.